Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Gerard Casey. I'm the head of the School of Philosophy, who's co-sponsoring this event, and I've been asked to moderate the question session. So first of all, a couple of ground rules. If you all want to ask a question, please approach the microphone. But before you rush to the microphone, the other and most important ground rule is that I'd ask you today, please, to confine your questions to the area involved in the lecture, namely language and mind, and not to the material which has been extensively discussed already in the previous sessions. Now you may rush the microphone. Secondly, when you do come to the microphone, could I ask that you ask a question and please not make a statement. Keep your questions short, okay? And so that's about it. So off you go then, so please come. Yes, sir.
I can slightly bend the rule that the professor mentioned. What I want to know, is it possible to deduce that fundamental human rights and freedoms are part of the fundamental human nature, or is that going too far? Or are they just simply constructs that are made by people in authority in order to grant or withdraw?
It's not impossible to deduce anything, and it's not possible to empirically demonstrate very much. But the human insight is quite powerful when you think about it. And we do constantly make judgments based on conceptions of freedom and justice in new circumstances. And we do it kind of reflexively over an unbounded range of human observation. And it therefore does follow, unless it's a miracle, that there are some principles that are part of our nature that determine the sort of generative ways of doing these. And you can study it. Actually, that's what Jack Rawls was trying to do in his work on the theory of justice. And in the last couple of years, there are experimental research projects on showing that children or adults from varying cultures in complex situations do make the same judgments, very strange judgments often. The problems that are studied, as you in moral philosophy will recognize, are problems that have come up, have been looked at carefully in moral philosophy by something called trolley problems, that category of problems, where it's true that people make strange intuitive judgments reflexively and don't know why. You just make judgments. So for example, harming someone on purpose is considered much worse than failing to do something which causes the same harm, even if you know it's going to cause the same harm. Actually, legal systems are based on that. But if you think about it, it's kind of weird because you're causing the same harm whether you do it or you fail to do something that's causing it to happen. And there are lots of things like this, and by now they've been studied extensively. There are some principles that have been suggested that you can put to experimental tests. It's a long way from getting to the problems of freedom and justice that we're interested in, but it's the direction we go. And the insight seems accurate. There's got to be some way in which we do it, and it must be something like the way in which and maybe they'll ultimately turn out to converge somewhere. As was in fact speculated in the 17th and 18th century, couldn't go beyond speculation. Now, if you look at the origins of classical liberalism and left libertarian thought that came out of it, classical liberalism is pre-capitalist, very much opposed to capitalism, contrary to what's said. But if you look back to classical liberalism, the connections with the creative use of language were explicitly drawn by people like Wilhelm von Humboldt, one of the founders of classical liberalism, also the modern university system, and also a very important linguist who tried to draw them together, even by Rousseau, a very complex figure. But if you look at more libertarian essays, Second Discourse on Inequality and so on, he connects, tries to connect, can't prove it, of course, but he tries to connect. Sort of starts with a strictly Cartesian account of failures of mechanism and tries to draw conclusions from that about inequality and liberty. And quite a long way to draw those threads together.
Hello, I'm Billy Dorn, I'm studying social science. And this question, do you think that language today could be that of a hegemonic nature? For example, that of a corporate state entity, and hopefully you'll be able to like connect this in with the influence of academic elitism that you've written a lot about, and mass media, and the predominance of English in the Western world.
Sorry, I didn't quite get it.
Okay, no problem. Just another thought in second social science. Would you be able to talk about the kind of hegemonic nature of language today, perhaps?
Nature of?
Hegemonic
language.
Hegemonic nature of language today, and perhaps out of a corporate state entity influence?
The influence of corporate state entity, what do you mean by the hegemonic effect of mind?
That through the prism of, say, mass media. And also the dominance of the English language in the Western world.
Well, I mean, these are interesting questions, but the linguistics and biology has nothing to say. I mean, these are questions about social structure, power, so on. Like, why does English dominate the world? Well, the main reason is that England was the most violent and the world power. United States, for example, British linguistics was unusually homogeneous. It had thousands of languages, people just like that, various government languages. But that has nothing to do with linguistics, that has to do with governments and savages.
Do you not see language like as inherently connected
with society? Why do people here speak English? Well, there's 800 years of history to explain it.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Benjamin.
Okay, my name's Eric Brennan, I'm public. Basically, I was just wondering, the kind of procedures, the study of the biological or just the evolutionary patterns and so forth that have created the patterns that exist in the human mind to determine not only the way in which our processes would be developed, like within our own outside hands, and also the way in which we'd be rather perfectly able to communicate with them to the outside world, as I can already test right now. How similar theories or similar approaches could be used to examine the minds, abilities of cetacean or other simian life and so forth to
the abilities of?
Of cetacean, like whales and dolphins, or of other
words.
Of cetacean. Or other, creatures and so forth, like how would
happen? They're all different from study them on their own. There is a lot of comparative study right now of animal systems. It's almost always called the study of animal communication because there is no evidence that anyone has that animal systems are anything other than communication systems. In contrast, human language doesn't seem to be a communication system. So, for example, if you look at the encyclopedic reviews of animal communication and evolution of communication, or say Mark Hauser's book on evolution of communication, he studies every kind of animal you can think of and looks at their communication systems. Actually, if you look closely at the book, it's not really about evolution of communication systems. What he shows is, and it's striking, with every system you look at seems marvelously adapted to whatever the animals try to do, bat catching mosquitoes or whatever it is. That just sets a problem for evolution. It doesn't answer the problem. Nice to think, well, it got that way by natural selection, but didn't tell us anything. Just saying it got that way somehow naturalistically. So it's not really the study of evolution of communication systems, but rather the comparative study of the variety of communication systems. As far as anyone knows, they all do seem to have the property that I quoted from Gallus, including cetaceans, namely they seem to be based on internal signals, if you want to think of it that way, that are one-to-one related to some identifiable phenomenon in the outside world. So let's say a vervet monkey has five calls. which when we look at it, and our anthropomorphic view, look like there's an eagle coming sort of our way or something, or there's a panther coming sort of climb a tree or whatever it may be. But what the animal's apparently doing is just reflexively responding to some phenomenon in the environment, like the eggs or something, or something like that. And every communication system that's been, and then communities is communicated with others, but they're very complex systems. Constellations are an example. But as far as anyone knows, that anything that's been analyzed is connected with hunting or locating one or something like that. There's a few categories. And it just seems uncorrelated with human systems. Human language does not even fit in the taxonomies that are used in the study of animal communication systems. And for the reason I mentioned, it may be a complete mistake to think of it as being primarily a communication system. It looks like it's primarily a thought system. And one of the things you do with thought systems is externalize the thought, and one of the things you do with externalization is communication. And after all, even if you just introspect for a minute, however significant this is, but this is a fact that almost all of your use of language is internal. You can't go a minute without talking to yourself. It takes a tremendous act of will not to talk to yourself. That's almost, statistically speaking, that's almost all language uses. And if you look at the small amount that is externalized, because it's quite small, only a very small part of that is communication in a meaningful sense. Humans find it difficult, for whatever reason, to be in the same place without talking to each other. Like if two of us have to be standing alone in a room, we're going to feel really uncomfortable unless we start talking. But we're not necessarily communicating. They ask you how what the weather's like, football computing or something. But the point isn't to communicate in any serious sense, it's just to set up some kind of social relationship, which we find very hard not to do. Of the small amount of language that is externalized, even a smaller amount is used to communicate in any meaningful sense, whereas in context of animals, it's indeed all it is. But we don't have any, maybe we don't have the right kind of experiments to do, but don't look like they're thinking.
Thank you very much. We're under severe constraints of time, so this will be the last question.
You said there was a consensus panel will be temporary time. So I was wondering if you could tell us what that was.
The misunderstanding of Turing papers?
Yes, thank you.
Well, there's a whole architect written about it. The Turing paper is a small paper, it's like 8 pages. It's created an industry of trying to determine whether the problem, the way it's formulated, is can machines think? Okay, it's the wrong way to formulate it in the first place, because by machines, people mean computers. And the only thing computers can do is serve as a paperweight. They can't do anything else. So the real question is, can programs think? Okay, well, what's a program? A program is just a theory written in some odd, in fact, nutty notation, so that a computer can implement the theory. Furthermore, it's a very crazy kind of theory, not the kind of theory that scientists construct. Because to get a computer to run a program, you have to answer every imaginable question, otherwise it crashes. Like when physicists construct a theory, they don't expect it to answer every possible question. If it can answer a fraction of the questions, they're delighted. What you're really asking is, can some extremely crazy theory, which answers every imaginable question in areas where we don't understand anything, can it think? And then you run into another barrier. What do you mean by thinking? Well, Turing already answered that question. What he said in his 8-page paper is the question whether machines can think, meaning programs, the question whether programs can think is too meaningless to deserve discussion. Now that's one sentence in an 8-page paper sort of regarding this, which means that the whole industry is based on a complete misunderstanding of Turing's paper. Now Turing's paper had a point, a sensible point, but a different one. Turing's paper for the set up what's called an imitation game. And it's basically a test to see whether you can fool people into thinking that some program is actually doing something creative. So you set up tests where you have a computer here and a person over there, another person behind the screen, questions go up and back. The person behind the screen has to figure out whether the answers are being given by a person or by the program computer. So it's a question of whether you can fool people into not being able to distinguish a program computer from a person. And these questions are actually pure scientific interest, approximately. but Turing nevertheless had a purpose in setting it up, a good purpose. He said, well, if we set up this problem, it may help develop better computers. It might be a way of spurring computer development and software design. Okay, that makes sense. You set up some tests, might stimulate computer design and programming. I doubt if it has, but it's a possibility. And he said also it might turn out that as a model, maybe it'll give some insight into whatever's going on and people think. And it's 1950, so it's 55 years. I think can't think of many successes in either endeavor. Now, this is true of a lot of what's done with computer programming. So, for example, it takes chess playing machine. Well, IBM has a big stake in having chess playing machines, but that's mainly to sell computers. It has absolutely no interest. Chess is a finite game. Okay, everyone knows it. So there is, you take enough grandmasters and give them enough time to think through every possible combination that's likely to come up, they're going to do better than one grandmaster who has 45 minutes or whatever it is to think of the next move. Yeah, that's true. So sooner or later, it'll happen. But you're supposed to get excited when it does happen. That's only because of being confused and misled about what programs are. In fact, the reason they call it machines is because then you kind of get these images of, Star Wars, funny robots doing all these great things. But all that it's doing is showing that if you have a lot of grandmasters sitting around for a long time, they can sooner or later do better than one grandmaster at a time limit. It's going to happen sooner or later. If it happens to spur computer development, okay, fine. But probably about all it does is waste time in philosophy to self-induce.
Thank you very much, and that brings me to the